the issues that are affecting the American people. And today, to be honest with you, I had one person here mention this issue to me.
Well, Vice President Pence knows better, and he has embarrassed himself, and that's unfortunate. You know, George Washington, in his farewell address to the nation, said that the Constitution is sacredly obligatory upon all. That means everyone. That includes former presidents of the United States of America, because in this great country of ours, no one is above the law. That is the defining principle of the Republic and has been the case for 247 years. And so I would urge everyone to just allow the prosecutors to do their job. I'm confident that the myriad of investigations will involve individuals who are professional. They will follow the facts, apply the law, be guided by the Constitution, and then we'll see where these investigations lead.
So let's talk about what they're doing up there. Y'all ready to listen? This thing was looked at by the previous prosecutor. Guy had been around for a long time. I think his name was Cyrus Vance. And the federal government looked at it and they said, no, thank you. So they elected this new guy. I think his name is Alvin Bragg. Mr. Bragg, you have helped Donald Trump amazing, and I'm sure he will say something to you down the road.
Being right or wrong about being arrested Tuesday wasn't really the point. He provoked people to react on his timetable. And as always, to use it in yet another series of fundraising appeals to the base. Adding to the mix, House Speaker McCarthy sprang to Trump's defense and called on the Republican-controlled House to, you guessed it, investigate the investigators, and to use Congress's power of the purse. In other words, defund the police.
Constantly, as I travel around the country, people are asking me, when is he going to be arrested and indicted? Is he above the law? Hasn't he done enough so that the American people can have faith and confidence that the law applies to him also?
Here's what the New York Times said about this. The case against the former president hinges on an untested and therefore risky legal theory involving a complex interplay of laws, all amounting to a low-level felony. You know what that means in English? They're making stuff up that they've never used against anybody because they hate Trump. That's what this is. They're brewing a legal cocktail, Tony, to try to come up with some bizarre theory of the law never used by anybody in New York. just because they hate Trump. You know why they're doing this? Because they're afraid of Trump. That's why they're doing it.
Yes, I started very early warning the American public about this president. I have never seen, most people have never seen or believed what we would have a president who has acted in the way that he has, who has disrespected the Constitution of the United States of America, who has lied, who has tried to organize domestic terrorists, and some believe that he did organize them as they attacked our Capitol on January 6th.
Part of the Trump playbook included trying to back his rival Ron DeSantis into a corner, with calls on the Florida governor to refuse to sign an extradition order on the chance that Trump would decline to leave Florida to face charges in New York. There was also pressure on DeSantis to comment on the case, on the theory that whatever DeSantis said would help Trump and hurt DeSantis.
I don't know what goes into paying hush money to a porn star to secure silence over some type of alleged affair. I can't speak to that. But what I can speak to... is that if you have a prosecutor who is ignoring crimes happening every single day, in his jurisdiction. Chooses to go back many, many years ago. To try to use something about porn star hush money payments. You know, that's an example of pursuing a political agenda.
As for Trump's calls and his supporters to protest and take the country back, there was a concerted effort by Republicans to deny Trump was calling for another January 6th. Marjorie Taylor Greene said just because Trump didn't call for peaceful protest, that didn't mean he didn't want it not to be peaceful. And Kevin McCarthy said this.
I don't think people should protest this, no. And I think President Trump, if you talk to him, he doesn't believe that either. I mean, I think the thing that you may misinterpret when President Trump talks, when someone says that they can protest, he's probably referring to my... educate people about what's going on. He's not talking in a harmful way, and nobody should. Nobody should harm one another in this, and this is why you should really make law equal, because if that was the case, nothing would happen here. And that is what has to transpire. Yes, ma'am. Have I spoken to who? No, I have not spoken to Trump, but you earlier in the question you referred to, I have spoken to Jim Jordan, and those are the appropriate committees. Remember, we also have a select committee on the weaponization of government. This applies directly to that. I think you'll see action.
Bragg himself didn't want to bring the case, but then he got pressured, I think, from the left. And I would say this, the one thing that has changed, the one thing that I think has changed his mind is President Trump announced he was going to run for president again. And suddenly, here they go. Now they're coming after him for some alleged bookkeeping error. You've got to be kidding me. So we want to know what kind of federal involvement may have taken place here. And okay. We want to know, did this stem from the Mueller special counsel investigation getting to this point as well? We want to talk to Mr. Bragg. We're asking him for the communications he's had with the federal government. We're asking him to come in and testify.
On a sliding scale of Trump troubles, Stormy Daniels is just for starters. There's the Georgia investigation of Trump trying to overturn Biden's win there, and federal investigations of Trump's role in January 6th, fake electors, the documents he took to Mar-a-Lago, to name a few.
This president has conducted himself in a way that he does not deserve not to be arrested. He should be arrested, he should be indicted, and the charges that he's been indicted on are minimal as opposed to the charges that I believe he could have been indicted on. What's going to happen when he announces himself? It's almost like he's attempting to organize his domestic terrorists to show up and to resist him being arrested. You have to be careful with him. We have to be careful about him making that announcement. He's doing it for a reason.
We are not involved in this, won't be involved in this. I have no interest in getting involved in some type of manufacturing by some Soros DA, okay? He's trying to do a political spectacle. He's trying to virtue signal for his base. I've got real issues I got to deal with here in the state of Florida. We're obviously shutting down CBDC, which is important. We've got so many things pending in front of the legislature. I've got to spend my time on issues that actually matter to people. I can't spend my time worrying about things of that nature. So we're not going to be involved in it in any way. I'm fighting for Floridians, and I'm fighting back against Biden. That's what I do every single day.
We announced under Chairman Jordan's leadership with Chairman Jamie Comer and Chairman Brian Steil, who have jurisdiction, that we expect and intend to call Alvin Bragg to testify.
He probably won't come, right?
Well, we are going to work very hard, and the American people deserve to have him come and appear, and we want to have access to any documentation between the Department of Justice and the Manhattan DA's office. In addition, there have been numerous members of Alvin Bragg's team who have left in very prominent fashion over the past few years, who have been focused solely at going after President Trump. other piece I would note here is, as much as I have been critical of the mainstream media in years past that many of you know, even the Washington Post has pointed out that this is a zombie case that the Department of Justice passed upon, the Southern District of New York passed upon, and yet now you have the most radical DA imaginable going after President Trump and doing the bidding of Joe Biden.
Another question in terms of that. Are you aware there has been any communication between Florida law enforcement and New York authorities if they do indict and President Trump does not go to New York for arraignment? Discussions about how he may be arraigned here in Florida since he resides here. Are you aware of any?
I'm not aware of anything.
The idea by Team Trump was to take some of the steam out of being the first former president to be indicted after being the first to be impeached twice. You have to remember that Trump's story is always taking the country deeper into uncharted territory. Up to and including now seeking re-election after losing the last election. And running on the idea that the biggest threat to Western civilization is Americans who don't support Trump. Not Russia and Putin's invasion of Ukraine.
Of March 2023, the International Criminal Court has issued two warrants of arrest in the Ukraine situation for Vladimir Putin. President of the Russian Federation, and for Maria Lvova-Belova, Commissioner of the Russian President for Children's Rights, for the alleged war crimes of deportation of children from Ukrainian occupied territories into the Russian Federation.
The International Criminal Court in The Hague issued an arrest warrant for Putin and the head of Russia's child services for war crimes, for rounding up children in Ukraine, abducting them, and forcing them into resettlement in Russia.
It is forbidden by international law for occupied powers to transfer civilians from the territory they live in to other territories. J. children enjoy special protection under the Geneva Convention. This is an important moment in the process of justice before the ICC. The judges have reviewed the information and evidence submitted by the prosecutor and determined that there are credible allegations against these persons for the alleged crimes.
Well, it's a good thing that he's a pariah. We know that Putin and Russia have been committing war crimes in Ukraine. Here they abducted Ukrainian children and forcibly put them in Russia. So this is a signal that the rest of the international community, the ICC, recognizes that war crimes have been committed. And so it will further isolate Putin, except, of course, from people like President Xi, who is traveling to Moscow.
Could you give us your reaction to the International Criminal Court issuing an arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin?
Well, I think it justifies it, but the question is, it's not recognized internationally by us either. But I think it makes a very strong point.
War crimes in Ukraine.
He's clearly committed war crimes.
As noted by the ICC itself, it has no way to enforce the arrest warrant on its own.
The ICC is doing its part of work. As a court of law, the judges issued arrest warrants. Their execution depends on international cooperation.
Coincidence or not, the ICC arrest warrant came right before China's President Xi went to Moscow for talks with Putin, a meeting that drew a prebuttal from the U.S., insisting that China could not be a fair peace broker unless Xi also met with Zelensky, and that there could be no ceasefire that leaves Russian troops in place in Ukrainian territory.
They'd like to rewrite the rules of the game globally, and they have been increasing their cooperation and their relationship, certainly of late. China has not condemned Putin's invasion of Ukraine. They are still buying Russian oil and energy resources. And they have at least given tacit approval because they've taken the Russian claim that this is somehow an existential threat against Russia, that the war is the West's fault. So we'll watch what comes out of this meeting here Monday through Wednesday of President Xi to Moscow, the state visit, if you will.
It is true that both of our countries share the same or similar goals. We have exerted efforts for the prosperity of our respective countries. We can cooperate and work together to achieve our goals.
We have said before, and we'll say it again today, that if coming out of this meeting there's some sort of call for a ceasefire, well, that's just going to be unacceptable. Because all that's going to do, Mike, is ratify Russia's conquest to date. Going to do is give Mr. Putin more time to refit, retrain, reman, and try to plan for renewed offensives at a time of his choosing.
We hope, and we've said this before, that President Xi will call and talk to President Zelensky, because we believe the Chinese need to get the Ukrainian perspective here.
Oh, and about that American drone that Russian pilots knocked out of the sky over the Black Sea the other day?
I don't know what the intention was of the Russian pilot. We can't really get inside and between his ears to figure out if he meant to hit that drone or not. It was absolutely unprofessional and way too aggressive flying on his part. Clearly, he did clip the propeller of that drone, forcing us to bring it down into the Black Sea. So aggressive, unsafe, unprofessional, reckless, quite frankly.
Well, I don't think we should be intimidated by the Russians or deterred from what we think is the right operational approach to this. You know, we shouldn't pull back our MQ-9s that are flying in the area. But let me reiterate that the Russians here have shown how reckless they are, how incompetent they are. Flew with, you know, Russian pilots in the backseat of my NASA jet for, you know, decades. I flew in space with Russians. I'm not surprised by this. I mean, I flew with Russian pilots, you know, fighter pilots who couldn't fly formation. And I watched this video, and it's pretty obvious what happened. He lost sight of it, and he crashed into it. He didn't do it intentionally, but it was reckless, and it's incompetence that we see on the battlefield every day in Ukraine, and that's why the losses that the Russians are suffering right now are really high. At this point, I mean, the best choice for Vladimir Putin would be to say, hey, this isn't working, and he's got to stop this illegal invasion. And, I mean, it's horrific what is going on in Ukraine with war crimes, and, you know, he's killing women and children.
Dan Rather, and you're listening to What's the Frequency, Kenneth? With musical host Paul Fisher in New York City.
On the aviation front.
Boarding takeoff, 2003.
Six close calls and counting.
Southwest aboard. FedEx is on the go. Delta 1943, cancel takeoff plans. Rejecting.
Including this one presented to a Senate hearing on aviation safety.
Heading 170 runway 18 left, clear for takeoff traffic 3 mile final is a heavy 767.
It had a FedEx plane coming in for a landing and a Southwest Airlines plane on a takeoff route.
Clear to land up 1811.
On the same runway at Austin Airport. Disaster averted.
Southwest aboard. FedEx is on the go.
Just one in a series of close calls, wing and tail clips, sudden dive, system outages, turbulence injuries, and out-of-control passengers. Enough to warrant hearings in Congress and the convening of an air safety conference.
We are still the safest aviation system in the world. There are clearly risks that we need to evaluate, and this is why the NTSB is investigating several incidents so it doesn't become something more catastrophic.
It's worth noting that Biden's nominee to run the FAA is facing headwinds over his safety expertise, and that currently the FAA is being run by an acting administrator, Billy Nolen.
The question is, what do they mean? Many years ago, while I was learning to fly, one of the first lessons my first instructor taught me was to listen to the aircraft. What's it telling you? That was a very important lesson that had stood with me throughout my entire career. And today, that's what we're here to find out. What is the system telling us? As a safety community, we must pay attention to the events of recent months and what the system is trying to tell us.
I think it's a difficult time for the aviation industry. Coming out of COVID, they are stressed. I think, you know, we saw a lot of layoffs. We saw a lot of employees retire. We have new employees coming on that are being trained. And then in addition to that, I think we have a pretty complex airspace with commercial space transportation. We have drones coming online, air taxis. So it's a difficult time, and it's really a transitional time for the aviation
America
industry.
America has the safest, most complex system in the world because of the work you all do and because of the standards we all hold ourselves to. We never settle, and when we see an issue, we move swiftly, and we find ways to move together. That's why we've asked everybody to come here today. And while the data are clear that U.S. aviation remains an exceptionally safe mode of travel, whether you compare it to other modes, whether you compare it to other places, or whether you compare it to other times in our own history, we take nothing for granted. And we are particularly concerned because we have seen an uptick in serious close calls that we must address together. Initial information suggests that more mistakes across the system, on runways, at gates when planes are pushing back, in control towers, and on flight decks. So today is about the entire system, which means it's about all of us. This is a key priority for the FAA, for the entire department, and for the Biden-Harris administration. I know it is for everybody who is gathered here. And that's why we're not going to rest easy with past success. We're going to consistently look for ways to enhance safety, including efforts that we already have underway, like rolling out the ASDEX taxiway arrival prediction features, modernizing airport infrastructure, moving forward with airport safety management system rules, and more.
The NTSB never forgets, not a single life lost. Zero is and always will be our goal. And I know it's many of yours as well. In calling for this safety summit, I'll call it a call to action. Billy said, now is the time to stare into the data and ask hard questions. I couldn't agree more. Too many close calls and near collisions recently, any of which could have had devastating consequences with precious lives lost. The NTSB is currently investigating 6 runway incursions since January. Including one at Austin, where the aircraft came within 100 feet of each other. Endangering the lives of 131 people on board 2 aircraft. The 2 planes in Burbank were within 300 feet of each other. Investigating 2 wrong runway landings that happened last June.
Scrutinize it and make sure that all of our policies are such that it makes it as, you know, as easy for women to access reproductive health care. But I think this is a real concern for women and our families all across the country. Mine are you with me. What happens in this court case is going to have an impact. So we're going to have to try to figure out how to make sure that abortion is still accessible for women. I'm going to take
mine of you with me. A Trump-appointed U.S. District Judge in Texas is still weighing whether to rule in favor of anti-abortion groups. And impose a nationwide ban on a drug used in medication abortions, one of two. The most common method of abortion in this country. So you say there's a chance. How could one judge ban an abortion pill, even in states that allow abortions? By overturning FDA approval of the drug more than 20 years ago is safe and effective.
Well, I can tell you the ruling, of course, is for the judge to make, but the bottom line is this. The Food and Drug Administration decided 20 years ago this drug was legal and safe, and it's been used since then in consistent with that FDA approval. Do you think about heaven? And now the opponents of this law or opponents of this measure are going into court and trying to reverse it. Think about that for a second. To take a drug that's been on the market legally and effectively for 20 years into challenging in a court, and one judge in Texas is going to decide for the nation, at least for some period of time, it shows the extremes these folks are willing to go to deny the basic access and basic rights of American women.
With or without a Texas judge's ruling on the abortion pill, the country's second-largest drugstore chain, Walgreens, caved to a threatening letter from 20 Republican states' attorneys general and agreed to stop selling the abortion pill. Even in states where abortion is legal.
I think the position of Walgreens is not clear at all. Doing the hard stuff. And I think it raises serious questions as to whether they should have taken this preemptive action or waited until this matter works its way through our courts. There are a number of questions that still have been not resolved at this moment. Let me say the bottom line, Andrea, as far as I'm concerned. This is a reminder to every person in America who's concerned about reproductive freedom that what's going on across America is nothing short of revolutionary. The elimination in the Dobbs decision of a constitutional right for women to make the choice on their own future was unprecedented. It never happened before. And now we're seeing it play out, not in the Supreme Court of the United States across the street, but in pharmacies around the nation. This is what you get when you decide that you're going to let every state legislature establish the law when it comes to something as basic as freedom.
We know that private industry is getting whipsawed by a lot of different politicians who are politicizing this important issue. They're making decisions that are going to impact women's lives, and we've got to hold them accountable.
I voted against the repeal. In 2018, that gave the regulators greater oversight over banks like these two that failed.
list.
I thought it was taking away, you know, critical elements of prudential standards and risks that should have been reviewed by the regulators. And I think that that vote opposing the repeal of that oversight ultimately is, you know, justified today, as we see. That's why I've joined Senator Warren and others in reinstating the obligations of those banks to be subject to our regulators at a more, you know, significant oversight.
Markets were on a hair trigger after the failure of those two banks. One based in California, the other in New York. And the watch was on for more dominoes about to fall.
Skinning and smudging walls. Walls.
Didn't help that First Republic and Credit Suisse were deemed to be in trouble, enough to warrant rescue plans. There were critics who said the banks were caught up in the Fed's plan to drive up interest rates to bring down inflation. And yet the loudest Republican voices seem to prefer making the bank failures part of the culture wars, claiming the banks failed because they were woke banks. Because, you know, Republican focus groups found woke is a buzzword that makes the GOP base salivate. Some of the fiercest criticisms based on business practices came from Democrats, who zeroed in on the Fed's interest rate policies. And I told you so. They said this would happen when the Trump-era Congress rolled back, with help from some Democrats, rolled back regulations on regional banks that were imposed in the big economic collapse of 2008.
But I also have to question the regulators. You know, they still had, you know, responsibility of oversight over these banks at the Federal Reserve. Was the Federal Reserve not looking? At their balance sheets, it seems to me that upon looking at them, there were warning signs. And what was the Federal Reserve, who is raising interest rates, thinking about as it relates to banks like these and maybe others that may be affected by their rate hikes and what that means to their depositors? So, there's a lot of questions to be raised here, but I think the regulators didn't get it right. And certainly, you know, those who repealed the oversight of these banks, I think in hindsight, they're probably saying, I shouldn't have done that.
Secretary Yellen, thank you for being here today. Do you agree with the president that we need to strengthen our banking rules?
Well, I think we certainly need to analyze carefully what happened that triggered these bank failures and re-examine our rules and supervision and make sure that they're appropriate to address the risk that banks face.
Okay, so we want to make sure we've got the right rules in place. And pretty obvious, we need some stronger rules here. So I want to talk about those rules, the stress test. Stress tests are critical tools in the regulatory toolbox that are designed to expose banks' vulnerabilities if bad things happen and force the banks to shore up any weak points before it's too late. Now, Secretary Yellen, when you are implementing the Dodd-Frank regulations as Fed chair 6 years ago, back in 2017, you said, quote, our stress testing regime is forcing banks to greatly improve their risk management.
All along, we called it normal.
And capital planning, end quote. But you warn that because, quote, we can never be confident that there won't be another financial crisis. It is important that we maintain the improvements that have been put in place that mitigate the risk and the potential damage, end quote. So I want to talk about those stress tests that you talked about, how important they were 6 years ago. Secretary Yellen, can regular, rigorous, well-designed stress tests help bank regulators spot problems lurking in banks' balance sheets and business models? Yes. Just for a while, then we close. In 2018, though, Trump's bank deregulation law and the door it opened for Fed Chair Powell to further hack away at the rules created an exception to annual Fed-administered stress tests, letting banks from $50 billion to $250 billion effectively off the hook. All is lost. Some hope is and that meant that a bank like SVB, which had $209 billion in assets when it failed, would be exempt from annual stress testing. It's not a dream. It's the sacred now. So the question I have here is, if the law had not, let's not just do stress tests. It's stress test, it's the whole package. Those who stand to gain draw dividing lines. Enhanced liquidity requirements that ensure that banks have enough cash on hand to meet their obligations, particularly in times of stress. Capital requirements that better position banks to absorb losses, regular resolution plans to help guide regulators safely through winding down failed banks. All of these were weakened in 2018, and when SVB failed, this is a part, in my view, of the Fed's actions that led to weaker regulation. You know, over the last few days, we've heard a lot of Republicans say that this collapse wasn't their fault. It was the banking regulators who were asleep at the wheel. And believe me, I have questions for a lot of the banking regulators. But Congress handed Chair Powell the flamethrower that he aimed at the banking rules. In fact, he said so himself, I'll quote and then I'll quit. When he announced that he was weakening regulations for the banks like SVB, Chair Powell said, and I quote, in the rules before us, we are applying the discretion granted to us by the Economic Growth Regulatory Relief and Consumer Protection Act. Translation, Congress opened the door to weaker regulations, and I'm waltzing right through it. That's true. Congress needs to close that door. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
My colleague has great experience in this, and I apologize for having to cut people off. Senator Johnson's next.
And sound bites on the program, you can go to the program's Facebook page. What's the frequency, Paul? I'm Paul Fisher.
I defended your drama. I'm a
Where'd it go? What'd it say?
Your audio device of choice. Ladies and gentlemen, the story up to now. In late August of 2005, a hurricane called Katrina approached the Mississippi Gulf Coast. The hurricane did severe hurricane damage, blew houses down along the Gulf Coast of Louisiana and Mississippi. It then moved inland and passed about 30 miles to the northeast of New Orleans, Louisiana. It did not directly impact or smash New Orleans. But what did happen at the same time is that the storm surge from the hurricane traveled from the Gulf to Lake Pontchartrain on the other side of New Orleans and burst through the flood walls of three canals meant to transfer rainwater from the city into Lake Pontchartrain. The storm surge tumbled the walls lining those canals and other breaches of the protective system, so-called, in approximately 50 different places across the city, all cooperated in flooding approximately 80% of the city. The Congress, in its wisdom, told the agency that it's built, that had built that system, which it admitted later was a, quote, system in name only, unquote, to try again, and gave it $14 billion to design and construct a new improved protective system, which the Corps of Engineers called a risk reduction system. We don't protect nothing. We reduce risk. The initial installation of that system included some pumps along the three canals that connect the city to the lake. A whistleblower from the Corps, Maria Garzino, reported on this show and in a subsequent feature documentary that those